few years ago, I had the opportunity to see 120 religious preference cards that had been filled out by freshmen in a prominent southern university. These 120 freshmen had spelled the word Presbyterian in 19 different ways. This is something of a remarkable achievement. Now, I do not suppose it is a matter of world-shaking importance that we send forth from our church schools and our churches young people who cannot spell the word Presbyterian. But it is very important that we send forth from our churches and church schools young people who do not know the meaning of the word Presbyterian. And more significantly, who do not know the meaning of life within the Christian community. As someone has well put it, whatever may be the religion of the average American, it is not something about which he can talk intelligently. Sometimes I think that may be true of those of us who are clergymen. We can talk intelligently about many things, about baseball, about football, about bridge, about golf, about business. But how many of us can talk intelligently about the meaning of our faith in the context of Vietnam, of a population explosion, of riots in our cities? Let us begin our coming to grips with this problem of doctrinal preaching with the simple observation that every man is a theologian. This is our destiny as human beings. There is simply no escape from faith and from theology unless we can some way disintegrate or live on a vegetative level. But to be a human being is to live by faith and to be a theologian. There is simply no way to escape life by faith and the theological enterprise if we are human. Life forces this upon us. Before we have been awake 2 hours any morning, we have to make decisions that are predicated upon some faith and upon some reflection upon the meaning of human existence. Life forces us to decide how we're going to treat our neighbors, how we're going to understand our daily work, how we're going to live together as families. We cannot make any of these decisions apart from some basic conviction about the nature of the universe in which we live and the purpose and the meaning of human existence. Any decision about the nature of the universe or about the meaning of human existence is a decision of faith. And any reflection upon the meaning of human existence is, however unconscious, theological reflection. All of us are theologians, and all of us live by faith. All of us reflect upon the meaning of human existence, and all of us commit ourselves in varying degrees to some kind of understanding of the nature of the universe in which we live and the purpose of our own particular lives. But this leads us a step further. The fact that we are all theologians and the fact that we all live by faith does not mean that we are all good theologians or that we are all Christian theologians. We're not all good theologians because we cannot all think clearly and consistently about the meaning of life. Our thoughts and our reflections are confused and contradictory and do not serve to clarify and to shape up the lives that we live. And neither are we automatically Christian theologians. That is, men and women who understand the meaning of human existence, the significance of Vietnam, riots in our streets, the choice of vocation, in the light of the fact that God himself has become embodied in Jesus of Nazareth. We're all theologians and we all live by faith, but this does not necessarily mean that we are all good theologians or that we all live by a faith that is adequate for life. In our own particular time, the theological task has become greatly complicated by at least three facts. And the first is, we now live in an increasingly secular society. If the church fails to do the job of Christian education in our society now, no one else is going to do it. In the community in which I grew up, it did not matter whether the church did it or not. The community did it. As a matter of fact, you had only one option, the option of Christian faith, as the community understood it. But this is no longer true. And furthermore, in our preaching, we cannot depend upon the congregation to give meaning to our words, as we could even two or three decades ago. I remember shortly after I finished the seminary reading H.R. McIntosh's book, Christian Experience of Forgiveness, and telling with a great deal of enthusiasm a friend of mine who had finished the seminary with me that after reading this book, I could preach the Christian doctrine of atonement with a sense of purpose and meaningfulness that I'd never been able to preach it before. And he somewhat ridiculed the idea. He said, "You do not have to understand the doctrine of the atonement. All you have to do is preach the cross," by which he meant that the more you pronounce the word cross and the more vigorously you assert the word cross, the more effective your preaching will be with your congregation. Now, he had found this to be true. If you said the word cross and other emotionally laden words with sufficient vigor and with sufficient frequency, the congregation, out of its store of Christian tradition and Christian nurture, supplied the meaning. And he had found this kind of preaching very effective. It was not necessary to interpret in many meaningful way what the word cross really signifies for human existence. All he had to do was to say the word, the congregation supplied the meaning. Well, that day is gone. Our situation can very well be summed up in one short sentence. We have witnessed in our time, and for many of us within the last 10 years, the culmination of the transition from the parish church in Christendom to the voluntary church in a free, pluralistic, secular, mobile, industrial, urban society. Now, if we can get all that I put in those adjectives, then we can understand the situation in which we live today very well. The transition from the parish church in Christendom to the voluntary church in a free, pluralistic, secular, mobile, industrial, urban society. Or to put it as Martin Marty does, the transition from a society in which all the cards were stacked in favor of the Christian faith and the Christian way of life to a society in which few, if any, of the cards are stacked in favor of Christian faith and the Christian way of life. To a society in which the options that are open to a man are increasingly numerous and human existence is increasingly free. The community in which I grew up in South Carolina was not Christendom, but it was Protestantdom. And we can say it was Protestantdom only with certain exaggeration. Only particular forms of Protestantdom. And this society was integrated around a Protestant, Puritan understanding of the nature of the meaning of human life. The public schools were church schools. I remember a church school teacher who called the roll and expected all students to reply with a Bible verse. And on days in which she was wanting to be very strict, she would ask you to reply with a Bible verse beginning with the same letter that your last name began with. And I always had a fellow sitting behind me with the name L, and I couldn't think of very many verses that began with L. This was a church school. The community was a church community. If you said boo to an atheist, he would have hidden in a corner. Protestantism as we knew it in the South has now been shattered in most places, though there are certainly fragmentary communities, isolated communities that still represent this Protestantism. The Protestantism has passed into a thoroughly pluralistic Protestantism, then a pluralistic Christianity with the mobility of people after the Second World War, and now with a fully pluralistic society. I remember being in Charlotte, North Carolina several years ago when the school board election was very intense, and hearing a woman running for the school board proudly announcing that she was Unitarian and that she was out for the elimination of the Bible in the public schools in Charlotte. I do not believe that anyone in Charlotte would have bragged publicly 30 years ago that she was Unitarian. This represents the pluralistic character of society in the South that previously had been Protestantism. The denominational pattern and the increasingly secularization of life in our society has destroyed not only Christendom, but Protestantism. And in this free, pluralistic, secular society without any official images, people are on the move. They no longer live and die in the same community. They live in many communities. And this, for middle-class churches, raises incredible problems of Christian education and Christian nurture. What does it actually mean to baptize a little child in our kind of society where people move and where there is so little sense of community between local congregations? In other words, we now live in a society in which we can no longer depend upon Christian nurture to supply meaning to words that are uttered but unexplained. We can no longer depend upon the community to do in its arbitrary ways what we in the church are not doing through moral suasion. This change, it seems to me, has certain important consequences for preaching. It has one particular consequence that is important for us as we talk about doctrinal preaching. Huldrych Zwingli could initiate the Reformation in Zurich by setting out to preach straight through the book of Genesis. I think this would be very effective preaching in Christendom. And in Protestantism or in Christendom, a minister could take an isolated text and expound it very effectively to a congregation that had the capacity to put this text in some kind of theological framework. But today it seems to me this preaching upon fragmentary texts, or even preaching straight through the Bible, cannot be effective in a pluralistic, mobile, and secular society. In our preaching, we have to set over against the various understandings of life and human existence that we discover in the world about us, the Christian understanding. For example, I think it is important that ever and again a preacher proclaim the doctrine of creation, not in fragmentary details on fragmentary and isolated Sundays, expecting the congregation eventually to pull it all together. But at one time to state, as a proclamation of the gospel, what the Christian church believes to be the doctrine of creation, and thus to set over against the various understandings of the nature of this universe and human existence within this universe, the Christian understanding of existence is wholly dependent upon God. And the same is true of various other doctrines of the Christian faith. This pluralistic secular character of our society demands that we set over against the alien faiths by which our people live in the church as well as without the systematic statement of the Christian understanding of the meaning of human existence. And now there is another factor that contributes to our present situation that makes doctrinal preaching urgent. And this second factor is the theological confusion of our day. The theological confusion is first of all rooted in what can be called a theological generation gap. There are in the Southern Presbyterian Church at the present time at least three or four theological generations that lack the capacity to communicate with one another. The oldest theological generation in our particular denomination has its roots in the Protestant Reformation, in the tremendous renewal of the life of the Christian community in the 16th century. Here is the theological generation that is rooted in the writings of Luther in 1520, the writings of John Calvin, and the Institutes of the Christian Religion. But the Protestant Reformation rapidly moves to a consolidation of this new discovery of the 16th century and what we call Protestant scholasticism, particularly the Protestant theology of the 17th century. It finds its written expression in our Confession of Faith that is based upon the Westminster Confession of Faith, upon the catechisms, and in the theology of Charles Hodge of the 19th century or Augustus Strong of the 19th century. This is a theology that the older generation, the generation that likes to call itself the dynamic centralist, learned in the theological seminaries. This is the theology that the dynamic centralists speak. And this is the only theology that many of the dynamic centralists in our church speak. The theology of Hodge, the theology of the Westminster Confession, the theology of James Henley Thornwell. But this is a theological generation that now belongs to the past. And it came to an end in the 19th century for many people. Certainly it came to the end in 1918, 1919, with the beginning of the Bardian era. And you had the great renewal of theology, in which theology went beyond the fundamentalist liberal controversies of the 19th century. The Christian community responded to the challenges of the Enlightenment in the 19th century in three different ways. One way was fundamentalism. Fundamentalists said it just ain't so. Or if it is so, we aren't going to have anything to do with it. They defied the 19th century. The liberals said we shall assimilate the wisdom of the 19th century. We shall incorporate this into the life of the church. And of course, the great danger was that in incorporating the wisdom of the 19th century, the wisdom of Marx and Freud and Darwin and Nietzsche and all the others, was that they would evacuate the meaning of Christian faith. And then the third reaction was the social gospel, which was concerned with how do Christians live in this new kind of industrial society. The pattern of Christian life had been worked out in a rural agricultural society, and now Christians lived in an industrial and city society. And the question arises, how do Christians live in this new kind of situation? Christians knew what it was to be honest when you had a farm and maybe two or three employees on the farm. What does it mean to be honest if you happen to be president of General Motors? Now, the social gospel in its original days was very naive. The great tract of the social gospel movement in his steps by Charles Sheldon simply tried to solve the problem by asking, what would Jesus do? In these ways, the church responded. Fundamentalism that said it just ain't so. Liberalism that said it is so, and we're going to have as much of it as we can in the life of the church. The social gospelers who thought that they could resolve in a very simple way the problems of this new and very complex society. Well, theology gets beyond this in the theology of Barth, who is neither a fundamentalist nor a liberal, and who builds upon but does not deny the social gospel. And it got to the United States with Reinhold Niebuhr's Moral Man and Immoral Society in 1932. This was a great theological era. And we have many ministers in our church who are the children of this era. The theologians whom they understand are the Niebuhrs, the Tillichs, the Barths. This is their native language. And when they read Hodge, this is a foreign language. They may be able to understand it, but it is not the language on which they were nurtured. The language on which they were nurtured was the language of Niebuhr and Barth. Now, the problem is that so many people who were educated earlier in the church cannot read Barth intelligibly, cannot read Tillich intelligibly, because this is not the native theological language in which they were nurtured. And therefore, many of the older theologians, the older ministerial leaders in the church, and this is true of congregations, simply cannot talk intelligibly to members of this younger theological generation, for whom Niebuhr and Tillich and Barth were the theological language in which they were nurtured. And now, the Barthian era is over, since around 1954. And for the last decade, theological students have regarded the Niebuhrs and the Tillichs and the Barths as belonging to historical theology. Consequence is, and in the Southern Presbyterian Church, you have these four or five theological generation gaps. And you have the pathetic situation of men who graduated from the seminary and who then became solidified in a theological era that passes. And they are now aliens in the theological climate in which they live. There are a great number of men who are in leadership positions in the Southern Presbyterian Church now who could carry on a very fluent theological conversation with James Henley Thornwell if somehow he could reappear on the face of this earth, but who cannot carry on an intelligible theological conversation with an intelligent theological seminary graduate of the past 20 years. This is the theological confusion. And this is also the judgment that comes upon us when we die theologically. This is the fate that sometimes awaits theological seminary professors who think that they have the truth once and for all delivered to the saints when they are appointed to the seminary faculty, and forget that a great many things will happen in theology before they retire. Some of us live under somewhat anxiously and nervously under this possibility. Theology is never done for eternity. Theology is done for today, and therefore the theological task is a very difficult task, an excruciatingly difficult task that requires discipline, that requires hard work. But this is the price that must be paid by an effective minister in our time. This is the confusion of the theological generation gap that is such a painful fact in the life of the Presbyterian Church in the South at the present moment. And it's not only a painful fact in the official life of the church, it is also a painful fact in the life of the local congregation. Four Sundays ago, I was preaching in a church and waiting for the 11 o'clock service when a member of the adult Bible class was talking with me, and he said, "You know, the interesting fact is that our new minister talks the same language that we have read in Waldo Beach's book, The Christian Life." He said, "You know, when we first read Waldo Beach's book, said this was strange. We never heard anything like this," and they hadn't heard it from the previous minister. But their new minister talk this language. This is a problem in the life of the local church. Now, the great temptation of the parish minister is that he will succumb to dependence upon the language of piety, a very confused language that he finds in the congregation when he arrives, and that his preaching will conform to this. And if it does, he cannot claim in any sense to be a doctrinal preacher. Doctrinal preaching is very demanding of intellectual work. And we just have to face this fact of keeping up with what's going on. And theology becomes increasingly complicated. We hear today about how much harder medical students have to study now than was the case 30 years ago. Now, this no doubt is true. It's certainly true in theological education. 30 years ago in Presbyterian Seminary, you could tell a boy to read Charles Hodge's systematic theology, or strong systematic theology, and he could memorize the heads of this theology, and this is it. And as long as anyone accepted the premises of this theology, if he knew it well enough by manipulation of these various premises, he could answer almost any question. This is no longer a possibility. And a theological student today has a much more difficult job when he has to know a tradition of the church, and he has to stand in the contemporary situation where there is no one overriding systematic theology that he can learn and study. He has to know different theologies in their interaction one with another. This requires a kind of intellectual discipline and stamina such as not been required from ministers in the church except in few generations in the entire history of the Christian community. The significance of the theological confusion in our time, I think, also calls for a second emphasis, in addition to a new concern for theological competence. It requires a second emphasis in our preaching, and that is for a positive theology. I think we have to pay attention to the style of life and the style of theology that is appropriate to the situation in which we stand. In the 25 years that I've been familiar with the Presbyterian ministry, I think the situation has changed. There certainly was a need 25 years ago for graduates of our seminaries to say what they did not believe. There was a need for young men to stand up and say that they could not affirm the virgin birth. There was a great need for many of them to stand up and to say that they could not affirm a particular doctrine of inspiration. The sterile, brittle crust of orthodoxy had to be broken. And we owe a great debt to those who did break it. But it seems to me that today the need is for positive theology, to say what we do believe. As Albert Outler has put it very well, the times are far too serious for so many Christian teachers and theologians to be playing Russian roulette with the great and central doctrines of the Christian faith. We pass through this with the so-called death of God theology, in which some ministers and many college teachers gave the impression that they were glad that there were no God, or at least the possibility of there being no God. If there is no God, we ought not to brag about it. This is a very serious and solemn fact. And today in our congregations, it is not likely that many of our parishioners are going to think that we believe too much. Many of them are going to wonder if we believe anything important enough, and that we believe it passionately enough for them to stop off at 11 o'clock on Sunday morning and hear it proclaimed. Out of the theological confusion in our time, there seems to me to be a need for positive doctrinal preaching. The third fact about our time that makes doctrinal preaching a necessity is mass media that thrusts itself into our lives in ways that we cannot control. In the community in which I grew up, my parents and the community could very much control the influences that would play upon my life. They could exercise the role of censor. and the influences that played upon my life were relatively few. But today, with the TV in our kitchens and in our dining rooms, with slick paper magazines on the bookshelves, not only of bookstores, but corner drugstores, it is absolutely impossible to control the play of influences that continually flicker across our pathway. More than a year ago, I was at the conference at Notre Dame on the Second Vatican Council, and someone asked several of the Roman Catholic leaders there if this thing was for good, would the reform continue? And the most effective answer was by a theological seminary professor who said, yes, it will continue, because there is no way in the world to keep Roman Catholic seminarians from reading Time magazine. There is no way to isolate a human being in our society from the multiple influences that play upon his life in the mass media of our time, in a way that even 25 years ago, the lives of most of us were isolated. These are three new facts about life in our time that seems to me to make doctrinal preaching a necessity. An increasingly pluralistic, secular, mobile, industrial, urban society. Theological confusion and the impact of mass media upon our lives. The times in general demand a return to doctrinal preaching. And this is especially true for those of us who are Presbyterians. We belong to a tradition that has emphasized the importance of the life of the mind in the service of God. We've always been suspicious of those who have said it is enough to feel your religion. We have known that while people felt their religion, they have committed every crime in the book. Therefore, we have always been suspicious of feeling. We have not been too certain about doing, but we ourselves, in our Puritan Calvinistic tradition, have been great doers. The emphasis that really distinguishes us from the rest of Christendom has been our concern with the life of the mind as a service of God. We have said that it is of critical importance for a man to know what he believes and why he believes it. This is the reason we have said only an ordained minister can perform the sacrament of baptism. Not because he has any magical power, but because baptism has to be performed in the context of teaching. And the preacher is the one who is certified by the Christian community as competent to teach. Apart from the ultimate answer of the power of the Holy Spirit, the validity of a Protestant minister's work depends upon his ability, by discipline of life and mind, to interpret the Word of God. This has been the emphasis that has distinguished us as Presbyterians. We have said it is important to know what one believes and why. Well, now let us come a step further. And let us ask, how is it that one becomes an effective preacher of Christian doctrine? Well, there is no one and simple and easy answer to this question. I have no gimmick to offer. I have no technique that can be laid down in 1-2-3 order to say, do this, and you will be a great doctrinal preacher. Doctrinal preaching, like theology itself, is an art. We can learn a great deal about the technique. But in the final analysis, a doctrinal preaching, as well as theology itself, is an art that we have to absorb out of the theological context and environment in which we live. But there are some things that we can do. And if we do them, it is more likely that we shall be effective doctrinal preachers. I would suggest that if one wishes to be a doctrinal preaching, the first thing that he ought to be concerned to do is to master one classical statement of Christian theology. I suppose that for those of us who are Presbyterians, this would be John Calvin. We cannot know the whole of the history of Christian doctrine. I remember once when I was studying Calvin, reading the preface to George Harkness's book, John Calvin and the Man and His Ethic, in which George Harkness boasts that in writing this book, she went through Calvin's writings meticulously, page by page. Well, knowing her age and some of the other things she had done, and knowing the size of the Calvin corpus, I thought this was a rather dubious boast. But at that particular time, I happened to be using the Calvin corpus that she had used, and I discovered a great many pages that had never been opened because they were still bound. Georgia Harkness had simply not lived long enough to have read all that Calvin wrote meticulously and carefully. You cannot know the whole of the history of Christian doctrine, but you can know one classical statement of the history of Christian doctrine with some measure of competence. And this can give an orientation to your theological work that saves you from what may be called faddism. It's very interesting to note in our time how the faddists in theology have been caught out on a limb. This was particularly illustrated in the so-called Death of God theology. Some of you may have attended the Emory University colloquium on radical theology and its future in America about 2 years ago. I do not think I've ever gone to a conference where every college Bible teacher was in attendance to the degree in which it was true of this conference. This was the wave of the future. But already, the wave had crested and the movement was dying. And many of those who had announced that the great new theology was the Death of God theology had the limbs sawed off behind them. This is the fate of being a faddist in theology, particularly in a time such as this, when new theologies are almost a dime a dozen. If one has his roots in a great tradition of Christian faith, then he is saved from the perils of faddism. And out of this tradition, he can carry on a conversation with all the new things that happen in theology in a creative and an effective way. We can depend upon and build upon the common sense wisdom of the Christian community through the years. Therefore, it seems to me, if one is to be a doctrinal preacher, he needs to begin by knowing one classical statement of Christian theology. And secondly, it seems to me he ought to have as one of his possible objectives in the future the knowledge of one of the great major theologians of the 20th century. And for me, these would be limited probably to three: Barth, Rhino Niebuhr, and Paul Tillich. There are other great theologians, but these are the most creative theologians, the most significant theologians whose work is likely to shape the future. Therefore, in any program for doctrinal preaching, I would put after the mastery of a classical system of theology, the mastery of one of the really great theologians in our time. And then thirdly, I would put the mastery of one theological problem that concerns us in our day. There are a great many problems in theology, and we cannot know them all. Not even if you are given this responsibility on theological seminary faculty. Life is too short, human mind is too limited to be a master of all the theological problems that confront us today. But one can gain some kind of competency, at least in one of the theological problems in our time. One of the most crucial of which is, how does God work in the created order? If you have pneumonia, how does God work in this particular situation? We know that God works through the medicine that your doctor gives, that God works through the skill of the nurse, God works through the psychosomatic effects of prayer. But does God work in this situation in any other way? How does God work in the created order? Or the problem of natural theology, how do you move from the world to Christian theology, or from Christian theology to the world? The problem of religious language, how do you use language in stating the Christian faith? There are many problems that one can indicate. So the first step, it seems to me, if one is to be a doctrinal preacher, is to know theology and to know it sufficiently well that one can move from the language of theology to the language of the street and the marketplace and put this theology in the concrete, specific language that men use in talking one with another in the streets. And the precondition for this kind of power of communication, it seems to me, is always a authentic and deeply personal knowledge of what the Christian community has understood about its own life. It's found in one of the great systems of theology, one of the great theologians of the 20th century, the way in which the church has grappled with a particular theological problem. The second step in becoming a doctrinal preacher, it seems to me, is the study of great doctrinal sermons. In my own ministry, I think I learned a great deal from the sermons of Harry Emerson Fosdick, not because he was a great doctrinal preacher, which he was a great liberal preacher. And interestingly enough, almost all the great preachers in America have been liberals in the first half of the 20th century. We talk about liberalism dying, but you think back about Harry Emerson Fosdick, surely one of the greatest. I would say Reinhold Niebuhr is probably the greatest preacher. Reinhold Niebuhr, while he goes beyond liberalism, was deeply rooted in the liberal tradition. I simply throw that out. But when in my own ministry, one of the things that helped me more than anything else was reading the sermons of Harry Emerson Fosdick for their structure, for the techniques, for the use of language, for the ways in which he made his points or made his transitions. We can become great doctrinal preachers only as we study the preaching, the great doctrinal preachers. The great doctrinal preacher of previous generation, Charles Jefferson, has something to teach us. But particularly in our time, I would suggest the doctrinal sermons or lectures of Reinhold Niebuhr, who in a very remarkable way combined the great theological insight with the capacity to preach. And thirdly, if we're going to be doctrinal preachers, it seems to me that we have to place a great deal of emphasis upon planned preaching. You cannot confront people with the meaning of the Christian faith unless you plan to do it. That is to say, you cannot do it in a fragmentary way when you happen to preach on this particular theme this day and you happen to preach on this fragment of a theme another day. It seems to me that if we are to be doctrinal preachers, we have to plan that in each year's preaching, we shall confront this particular congregation with the Christian understanding of life within the Christian community and the Christian understanding of the Christian message. If we pay attention in at least a rough way to the Christian year, we shall touch upon the great themes of Christian doctrine. The incarnation, the passion and atonement and resurrection, Jesus Christ, the gift of the Spirit, life within the church. If we are to be doctrinal preachers, it seems to me we have to plan a year's preaching in such a way as to confront people with the gestalt, the wholeness of Christian faith, and if you do this, not 1 year, but 4 or 5 years in succession, the congregation will catch on. If I were to devise a way to test the effectiveness of a minister, I would work out some kind of test whereby you could evaluate the sermon taste of his congregation when he began his pastorate and the sermon taste of his congregation when he ended his pastorate. There are a great many congregations that cannot appreciate great preaching. They could not understand that this would be like a language from Mars. They've never heard it. They do not know the language. They have not been trained to listen to preaching that demands a totally personal response. Therefore, they cannot receive good preaching. Most of our congregations are in this state because we haven't done very much preaching in the Southern Presbyterian Church. We've been a promotional church, an administrative church, not a theological church. This has been our tragedy. We have a great theological tradition, but we have not been a theological church. The one thing that the fathers of the church fear more than anything else in the General Assembly is a theological debate. They're perfectly willing to debate about the central treasury, but not about theology. If you have a theological debate going, they immediately call together a meeting of the church fathers and leaders in Atlanta to somehow put this down and get with the real task of the church, evangelism or raising the budget and so forth. This is the reason the theological life of the church has been impoverished. And we have been an emotional church, an administrative church. We have not really been an evangelistic church, nor have we been a theological church, which we should have been. And most of our congregations are not equipped to understand theology. But most congregations, I am convinced, can become theologically intelligent congregations in a five-year pastorate, if you keep it up for 5 years. And one of the real tests of the effectiveness of a man's ministry and his preaching is the difference between the capacity of his congregation to enter into the task of preaching when he began his ministry and the ability of his congregation to enter into the preaching work of the church when he ends his ministry. The trouble is, most of us ride upon what our congregation can do when we arrive, and they are no further along in theological competence and understanding when we leave. The real test of what we do theologically is to be found not in our printed sermons and not in what we say and do at Montreat, but in what really happens in the theological literacy of the congregation for which we are responsible. We can plan our preaching. I would say that if we plan our preaching, we shall pay attention to the church year so that we touch on the great themes of Christian faith during the year. I would also suggest that in planned preaching, we would enable congregations to see the deep meaning found in many of the obscure doctrines of our faith that have been relegated to the religious past. The sermon, say, on the meaning of predestination, or a sermon on the meaning of the perseverance of the saints. The fathers of the church in the 16th century were trying to say something very important and very significant for life in the middle of the 20th century when they talked about the perseverance of the saints. But a congregation now will never understand it if on Sunday morning you simply repeat this doctrine in the language of the 16th century without asking, what does this mean in the existential life of the congregation that is gathered here? What does it say to us about what it means to be a part of the Christian community? Sermons on obscure themes and sermons on the sacraments. What do we really do when we baptize a little child? Shortly after I came to Richmond, I attended a prominent church in this city in which the minister came down and baptized a little child. He did this in an ad-lib sort of way, theologically very incompetent sort of way. Then immediately he went back to the pulpit and said, now we are approaching the Easter season when all of our young people will be given the privilege of joining the church. Theological nonsense to baptize a baby and then walk back to the pulpit and give young people in the congregation, baptized young people, the privilege of joining the church. But this kind of theological incompetence, theological illiteracy, has been all too frequently a characteristic of life within our denomination. This is the reason Calvin insisted that you cannot baptize children apart from teaching, the context of teaching, and it has to be in the context of the preaching service, and this is the reason they moved the baptismal font from the back of the church and put it beside the pulpit. Well, how often we baptize children without ever giving the congregation instruction about what is actually taking place in the life of the community when this particular child is baptized, or how many times we celebrate the Lord's Supper without ever trying to state in any intelligible way what we mean about the presence of Jesus Christ in connection with this bread and this wine. This is what I mean by planned preaching. And if you do this over and over again, people will begin to understand what it means to baptize a little child or to baptize an adult or to participate in the sacrament of the Lord's Supper. And then I think in any planned preaching, we have a great opportunity for a series of sermons that can set over against the alien faith by which men live a great area of the Christian affirmation about meaning of life in our particular world. For example, you have a glorious opportunity every Christmas. You can approach Thanksgiving, say, with a sermon on creation. And then you can follow the sermon on creation with a sermon on the fall. And then you can follow this with a sermon on the messianic promise. And then a sermon on the incarnation. And I would suggest that if you work out a series following this line, creation, fall, messianic hope, the incarnation, if you do this for 4 years in succession, and you can easily do this 4 years in succession without repeating yourself, the congregation will eventually get the idea. And they can see the they can see the incarnation, this great celebration of Christmas in the context of our Christian understanding of the nature of the universe in which we live and human existence within this universe. You can't do it in 1 year, but I would suggest that if you do this 4 or 5 years, creation, fall, messianic hope, incarnation, repetition, and you can repeat the doctrine without repeating the words or without repeating the same treatment, within 5 years, you would have a theologically educated congregation. And then finally, if we are to do doctrinal preaching, we have to learn how to do theology. In our day, you cannot learn one theology by rote and say, this is it. There are varieties of theology that are open options for a member of the Presbyterian Church or any other church. And therefore, in one sense, more important than knowing a particular theology is to know how you go about doing theology. How do you go about being a theologian? And I would suggest that the answer to this, how we go about being a theologian, has to be understood in terms of dialogue. Theologian stands in what we might call a dialogical circle. By this I do not mean the faith circle which Tillich speaks. To be a theologian, you've already made the commitment of faith. I mean the theologian stands in what we can imagine as a dialogical circle. And around this dialogical circle are the various theological entities with which the theologian carries on conversation. A unique part of this circle would be the Bible. Because in our particular tradition, we emphasize that the Bible is a unique authority. But it is not the only authority. And elsewhere on this circle, we would have what we may call dogma or tradition or the creeds, which is how the church has read the Bible in the past. If we read the Bible today and discover in it something that no one else has ever discovered in it for 2,000 years, the burden of proof is on us to justify our particular discovery. The dogma, the tradition, the creeds of the church is the church's understanding of Scripture for these 20 centuries. And so we carry on conversation with the church. How is the church understood it? And then another segment of this circle would be Christian experience. How has this doctrine been experienced in the life of the Christian community? Some of our Protestant forefathers, particularly in the age of Protestant scholasticism, tried to carry on theology apart from experience. They simply deduced it out of the Bible. And then you got these remarkably cogent theological arguments that were brilliant logically. Theological problems had been solved by logic, but you suddenly discovered there was nothing in human experience that corresponded to these doctrines that had been stated with impeccable logic. And you had the reaction with Schleiermacher when he said that theology is a transcript of Christian experience. Theology is Christian experience in speech. But Schleiermacher went too far, some of us would say. But theology after Schleiermacher can never be the same again. And any sound theology has to ask, how is this doctrine experienced in the life of the Christian community? What do we know about it from experience? And then part of this theological circle would be culture. And here in culture, I would include social sciences, natural sciences, humanities, all the great knowledge of our culture, which has enabled us to learn things about theology that we never knew before, or never knew so clearly before. We learned from Karl Marx how theology very frequently is determined by the way we make our living. And there's a great deal of truth in that. You can document that in the Southern Presbyterian Church. If you think about it, the way people make their living and how much money they have in the bank radically affects their theological convictions, and especially their ethical convictions. Marx went too far and said this was overwhelmingly the case. We learned a great deal about original sin from Freud. And as Reinhold Niebuhr pointed out to Karl Barth, it's a very interesting thing that no one ever discovered that the Bible taught certain things about woman until after the woman suffrage movement and modern sciences of man. Barth had said over against Niebuhr that he got it all out of the Bible. And Niebuhr's answer said that this is just plainly not the case. You discover certain things in the Bible because of what modern science has taught you about woman. So part of our conversation is with culture in this broad sense. And then part of our conversation would be with the history of religions. Paul Tillich, in the last lecture that he gave, the night in which he had his heart attack, said that if he had to do his theology over again, his systematic theology over again, he would be in conversation with the living religions of mankind. Tillich wrote his theology in conversation with Enlightenment man, the humanist, in Western culture. But he said if he had to do it over again, it would not be in this kind of context, because increasingly the context in which theology has to be done will be in the history of religions. The theologian stands in this context of dialogue, and his theology is dialogue. Dialogue with these various factors that impinge upon his life, and it is never a finished task. As Karl Barth well put it, we do not write theology for eternity. We write theology for today. And once it is written, it has to be rewritten. Now, this is a very, there is no perennial theology, and this is a very trying fact. It would be so wonderful if we could formulate a statement of Christian faith and say, this is it, and live with it. But we have to continually reformulate the Christian faith in every new situation, with every new day, especially if we happen to be in an inner city parish, on some of the rapidly changing parishes of our cities. Now, I realize that a great many of us in the South still live in isolated communities. And much of what I say does not impinge upon the life of these churches just yet, except insofar as people who are in these churches look at their television sets and almost inevitably live in the modern world, though many of us have a strange capacity isolate ourselves from the modern world. We all have to live chronologically in 1967, but we do not have to live in 1967 theologically. Of course, this is one of the great problems of the minister, because in every congregation you have some people theologically living in 1800, and some people theologically living in 1861, some people are theologically living in 1900, 1918, 1954, or some of them living in maybe 1968, but some of them trying to live in 1975 or even 2000 A.D. And the problem of the minister is to communicate with these people who live in various theological ages in his particular congregation. Well, let me conclude by saying, before we have questions, the doctrinal preaching will deepen and enlarge the life of the Christian community. This becomes clear, I think, when we ask, what is the task of theology? What is the nature of the theological enterprise? I shall give three answers to that that are taken from great theologians in our day. Karl Barth has said that theology is a self-test to which the church puts its proclamation. It is the church trying to authenticate its message in the light of the revelation of God in Jesus Christ as attested in Scripture. For Barth, the real problem is heresy. The church must clarify, straighten out, authenticate its proclamation. Paul gives a second task of theology, and that is the interpretation of faith for every new generation. Theology is Christian faith answering the problems of human existence in a new time and a new place. This is the quality of all theology. Theology is not simply a message that's thrown out in which one expects the Holy Spirit to some way miraculously illuminate the Christian heart so that he can accept it. Christian faith must be proclaimed in such a way as to answer the real problems of human existence. Not necessarily the problems people are asking, because the questions people are asking are not necessarily the real questions. And therefore, theology has to get people to answer the questions that are the real questions of human existence and the questions for which Christian faith is the answer. And the third task of Christian theology is to clarify the Christian message and to indicate what it means to participate in the life of the Christian community. Theology is always about faith, about life in the Christian community. Theology is a clarification of what it means to participate, to be a part of, a member of this community. And if our preaching does these things, clarifies and authenticates the message, clarifies the meaning of participation in the life of the Christian community, and answers the questions, the real questions that men have to ask as those who live in the middle of the 20th century, then this will deepen the existential life of the congregation for which we are responsible. And it will enlarge that life through the witness of this community in the larger community of which it is a part. Too frequently, our preaching has been utterly trivial in a world that calls for great preaching, namely the proclamation of the Christian faith in its wholeness, and in language that is meaningful in our time. Well, there's various indictments of what goes on in our pulpits. All too frequently, to be found in a poem by A. E. Cumming that goes like this. O Father, my Father, oh, what must I do? They're burning our streets and beating me blue. Listen, my son, I'll tell you the truth. Get a close haircut and spit shine your shoes. Oh, mother, my confusion's removed. I long to embrace her whose hair is so smooth. Now listen, my son, although you're confused, cut your hair close and shine all your shoes. O teacher, my teacher, your life with me share. What books are I read? What thoughts do I dare? O student, my student, of dissent, you beware. Shine those dull shoes and cut short that hair. O preacher, my preacher, does God really care? Are all races equal? Are laws just and fair? Boy, here's the answer. No need to despair. Shine those new shoes and cut short that hair.